and welcome to the At Peace Parents podcast. I'm Casey, and I'm here to empower you in your decision-making as a parent of a demand-avoidant child. My goal is to share insights that will generate aha moments and support your connection with your child. I'm a mom of two amazing little boys, one of whom is PDA, and I've worked with hundreds of parents just like you to teach them how to lead their child out of burnout and find the clarity, peace, and sense of community they need. Hello, everybody. I am so excited to be here with my colleague and friend, Dr. Alex Klein. He is a clinical psychologist who has a ton of experience working with PDA children and teens directly, but also working with their families and with couples as well. And he works with families and children who are neurodivergent. We are here to talk all things PDA and to answer your questions from his perspective and from mine. So we have some questions that have been submitted. Before we dive in, I just want to say a little caveat that this is for educational purposes only and not medical advice. So welcome, Alex. How are you?
I'm doing well, Casey. I'm glad that we are finally able to talk about this. I feel like you and I both had to cancel one or two times. I'm like, finally, we found the time to do this. Yay. Yes.
Life. So, yeah, yes, a couple months ago, actually, Alex and I sent out a call for questions from the parent community, and we got tons of amazing questions, but we picked out some of the ones that were more frequently asked, and we thought we'd touch on them today together. So I'm going to ask you first, Alex, if that's okay. From your perspective, what are the similarities and the differences between ADHD and PDA?
Yeah, such a good question, because there is a lot of demand avoidance in ADHD. PDA is not the only thing where we see a lot of demand avoidance. So for example, many ADHDers, myself included, might have difficulty initiating tasks, right? Starting the tasks, right? Like, oh, I'm supposed to do this thing, especially a new thing, might be hard to get started there, right? So there could be some demand avoidance there. I think switching from one task to the next, right, can be really hard. So that can, hey, stop, put that thing down and go do this next thing, right, can be really hard for, you know, is a really common type of demand avoidance in ADHD, also seen, you know, demand avoidance along those lines in PDA. Notice that one of the differences, I think, one of the main differences between ADHDers and people who do not have ADHD is the ability to tolerate boredom is just almost non-existent for many ADHDers. So there can be a lot of demand avoidance there. You know, and I think that many ADHDers might also have some low frustration tolerance, right? So that can lead to some demand avoidance. So we see a lot of demand avoidance in ADHD. I think that, you know, those are some of the similarities. I mean, there's more similarities. There's so many. It's hard to, because I think that, you know, to the extent that we think of PDA as a subtype on the autism spectrum, we know that there's a lot of overlap between autistic people and ADHDers, right? Like probably, it depends on which study you're looking at, but probably more than half of autistic people also qualify for an ADHD diagnosis, so very high overlap. So, you know, things that we see in ADHD, you know, we're also seeing in you know, the broader autistic population, like higher likelihood of negative comments from others. You know, there's some study that, you know, by age 10, ADHDers are more likely, you know, like 20,000 more critical remarks being made to them than people without ADHD. Like really kind of, you know, we could see that there's sort of a more burnout or cumulative overwhelm, you know, in both populations. I think there's a higher likelihood of experiencing trauma or bullying, you know, related emotion regulation challenges, or again, you know, more avoidance of situations where they might be criticized or punished in some way. So like really common, I think, in with both ADHDers and PDAers. Some of the positives, you know, similarities, like I we know from some really cool studies showing how that actually creative problem solving skills for many autistic and ADHDers, for many autistic people, and are actually higher than a neurotypical population, including the ability to see patterns and connections between things that other people might not see. Another similarity is that the need for novelty is big in ADHD. It's another thing that comes to mind. There's so much. What am I missing, Casey? I feel like I'm missing stuff there.
Well, my expertise isn't in ADHD. And so let me just bring in an anecdote, which I think hopefully will help us clarify a little more. So my dear friend and web designer and tech gal here locally in Michigan is an ADHD woman, right? And we've had this conversation on our walks together as entrepreneurs and friends. You know, she has a lot of demand avoidance, exactly as you said. And she's like, well, how do we know if this demand avoidance is related to my ADHD or the perception of a loss of autonomy or equality, because she has a degree of that as well. So I would love to understand from your perspective as an ADHD person, how do you know that you don't have PDA demand avoidance?
Good question. Yeah, and that really gets, that's a good segue to the differences, right? Because I think that there's several things, right? I mean, I think for PDAers, my sense is sort of the need for control and autonomy is very central. And it's a difference of extremes too, right? Mm-hmm. You've said, and I've sort of taken this in from you, you know, this core difference in, you know, demand avoidance to the point of overriding basic survival instincts. Is that how you put it? I really like the way you put it.
Yeah. That's the threshold for the category, I think, to qualify it as a nervous system disability, PDA.
Right.
Where the survival drive for autonomy and equality consistently overrides other survival instincts like toileting, eating, safety, hygiene, and eating, right. And or eating.
Right. So you don't have to
agree with me on these calls.
No, I do agree. I do agree with you about that. And I think it is a difference of extreme. I think that, you know, I mean, demand avoidance is a part of life. I mean, I most people procrastinate on stuff, for example, right? Like, you know, that's not just ADHDers or, you know, but again, like with PDA, if we're thinking of this as a subtype on the autism spectrum, again, there's differences in like broader sort of diagnostic criteria that we're looking at that might be more present for the PDA or than for someone who's ADHD and not PDA. So like, for example, the need for routine, you know, very high need for routine in the autism spectrum, or some of the sensory processing differences. Although again, there's many ADHDers that have sensory issues but it's not in the actual criteria, you know, the criteria the same way it is for autism spectrum. So a lot of similarities, but definitely still those sort of important differences. Did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I like to think about the root cause of the behavior, even if the behavior looks similar across different neurotypes, right? So like sensory can cause demand avoidance, trauma can cause it, executive functioning differences, perception of threat, whether it's related to autonomy and equality or not. So the other thing, and please correct me because I don't work with families with ADHD children, although I think most of the families that I work with have PDA kids who are also ADHD, like my son.
There's a big overlap.
But one of the things we see behaviorally with PDA that doesn't seem quite as consistent, prevalent, or exactly the same flavor is the sort of the equalizing behavior towards another person of a PDAer to try and get back to a place of nervous system safety. So,
definitely.
You know, it's not just the avoidance. It's like when the nervous system perceives a threat, there needs to be the counterbalance to get back to a place of control and safety. And that,
yeah,
at least with externalized, like more fight flight, externalized PDAers is often directed at the safest person in the household or the weakest, like a sibling.
Right.
And that can look like anything from like destroying their things in a impulsive, fixated way. Like if you tell them not to, it's even more driven towards doing that.
Taking
destroying the mom's tomato plants because those are the plants that she loves the most, or taking off the leaves of a plant, or controlling the parent's behavior, like what they're allowed to say, where they can sit, whether they can go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And you tell me, like, is that a core feature of ADHD as a standalone?
No, it is not. I think I'm really glad you brought that up, right? I mean, I think it intersects with, you know, some things we said around, you know, higher need for control or predictability, but certainly this piece around, you know, the kid not being able to do something that we might want them to do unless, you know, they've done A, B, and C to put them in a place of equality, right? So they're not feeling below in
like
some
no
way.
One's above them. Or
Right.
Yeah. And I think for parents, well, for everyone, it can be confusing because sometimes this isn't like a cause and effect in the moment with PDA.
Yeah.
They might go to school, experience internally all these nervous system threats, internalize
right.
it or like mask that, and then come home to the safe nervous system, the mom usually, the home environment, and then they move from more shut down into fight flight and equalize against the mom of like stop talking, swearing at them, destroying, you know, their siblings' things when nothing has preceded that to proceed.
Yeah.
Like the parent hasn't even made a demand. They've just walked in the door and
yeah.
the kid starts doing this because they're trying to get back to a place of safety, like from
right.
the survival part of the brain.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So
right. I agree. Yeah. And I think that you're right that we could not, you know, say, oh, well, ADHD accounts for these aspects. Yeah. That would not be ADHD.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
cause I'm like here, if we're just being totally clear, like I'm not a clinician, so I'm not trained in ADHD behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
well, no. You're parents of an ADHDer, right?
Yeah, but even for me, sometimes it's hard for me to parse, like,
yeah,
like what you mentioned, the intolerance of boredom, right? Like that's
mm-hmm.
a pattern that you mentioned as similar. And, you know, that's a core feature of many of the families I work with and with my son who just walks around saying, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored. But
right.
then make a suggestion or come up with a lot of ideas that are dopamine fueled. And it's
mm-hmm.
no, because you've suggested it.
You were the one who suggested it, right? It wasn't, you know, an autonomous decision initiated independently by him.
Yeah. And then the other thing is like how I viewed him before PDA was like sensory processing disorder and possibly ADHD, because he was like, he appeared manic to me, like so hyperactive that he couldn't be still.
Mm-hmm.
But as we worked through an accommodation lens, the PDA lens, like a lot of that, what I thought was hyperactivity or lack of focus came down. And I realized it was actually more fight flight behavior, which was
yeah. related. Anxiety, emotional dysregulation underlying a lot of that for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think sometimes it's what we dorks call an empirical question of like,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think for a lot of families, they'll try ADHD supports that are more behaviorally based and it makes things more
mm-hmm.
difficult in the home. And then they
start oh, yeah.
to explore, oh, maybe there's a different root cause.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a really good point, right? Because we do think about, you know, intervention a little bit differently or sometimes a lot differently, right? If we're talking about, you know, just ADHD, you know, but then, you know, some of the interventions that are suggested there might be really harmful or backfire with your PDAer, right?
Yeah.
So really challenging.
So maybe you won't be able to answer this on the spot, but like I notice patterns among my large end sample of parents of PDAers. So I have a really specific vantage point.
Yeah, sure.
But do you have patterns that you've noticed among the families of ADHDers, like where their challenges are that might be distinct from the parents with PDAers? Or is it a common theme where it's like so for example, my hypothesis without having worked as a clinician with ADHDers would be, and this could be wrong, would be there's a lot of similar challenges of like constant hypervigilance in the home, higher stress in the home, trying to understand the kid. But for ADHD, it seems like it's a word and a category that people understand. Right. So the parents
mm-hmm.
of ADHDers may have similar challenges in some ways, but like when you say the word, you are automatically grouped with another category of parents that like make sense to others in the world, like clinicians and doctors. Whereas with PDA parents of PDAers, it's often like, you know, there's this added layer of like isolation and self-doubt and just like, are we crazy?
Mm-hmm.
That might not exist if it's like just a clear ADHD diagnosis, but I could be wrong because
Yeah, really great question. I think there's elements of that, like of am I crazy or if my kid hasn't been diagnosed with ADHD, but they probably should have, right? Like there can be sort of some overlapping elements there, but there's definitely differences in the degree of how extreme it gets, right? And then again, like for example, not being able to, eat or not being able to go to school, right? Like, is it going to be more likely to happen these types of more extreme things in someone a PDA or as opposed to an ADHD, right? So it can be difference of extreme. It's also not to invalidate the challenges that many ADHDs experience and the challenges that families experience, maybe not getting a diagnosis when they should or this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I definitely see it as sort of a difference of extreme. And I think you're right that that experience of like feeling like, am I crazy or why are people not, why is the advice I'm getting not working? Like that is more unique to PDAers than it is to ADHDers, who maybe some of the more standard sort of accommodations or suggestions to kind of work with these types of issues are going to be more likely to work, I think.
Yeah. Okay,
Yeah.
cool. Very
Yeah.
cool. Well, before we move on from that question, similarities and differences between ADHD and PDA. If someone walked into your office and was like, "I don't know if my kid is ADHD or PDA, can you help me?" What would be your first step or question for
Would
them?
be like to ask them like 8 million or so questions.
Okay.
Like I feel like that's such a stereotypical like therapist-y thing to do is to like answer a question with like a million questions. But yeah, I mean, I think it would take some real investigation as to the history. I like to ask parents right around like what kinds of things they've tried and have they worked or not. And I
Yeah.
like to believe them what they tell me. I think that's sort of a problem where like sometimes parents are not actually believed when they're told like, oh yeah, no, I tried that thing and it didn't work, so yeah, but I mean certainly in parsing it all out, right? Like there's broader questions about ADHD and experiences in school and what happens if you try to get your kid to do some homework, what kinds of reports from teachers have we had? I mean, many different questions. We're looking at parent and teacher questionnaires, some of these assessment forms, autism spectrum and PDA, right? Like we're looking at sort of, again, there's some overlap, but a different sets of social differences, need for routine, these kind of questions. So yeah, so it's a lot of questions, but I would say like you're in the right place, like we're gonna have to tease this out step by step here.
Yeah, I do like a pattern I've noticed just to round out this question from a parent is exactly the same as what Alex said of like, what have you tried? What is it? What has worked and what hasn't? And can we believe ourselves that if it hasn't worked, it doesn't mean that you're doing it wrong, but maybe we look at a different lens. But I will say that it's a common precursor. Like, I often find there's like two categories of families that find me because, or find PDA because it's like the last stop, right? And so one category is like autism diagnosis, do the behavioral approaches, maybe ABA, and if things get worse or the kid goes into burnout and then they explore PDA. Or it's more the like behavioral, maybe it's ADHD, maybe it's sensory processing, and then it's ADHD because there's like, at least the conventional wisdom is you can't be autistic if you're social, make eye contact, and have friends, which these PDA kids often do. And so
Right.
ADHD is like the precursor to then finding out about PDA.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I definitely see that actually that pattern of a lot of the families I assess where there's a child, or sometimes even when I'm assessing an adult, it's much more likely that the if there is a diagnosis that ADHD came first, then we might end up towards another diagnosis, but not always, but it
Yeah.
does happen more often that direction.
Cool. Okay. Hope that's helpful, parents who asked that question. I think we had like, what, four people who asked that?
Something along the, yeah, at
Yeah.
least, yeah.
Okay, cool. Do you want to read the next question or do you want me to?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I'm not going to be able to answer this next one because it's about psychology.
I feel like you have important, we kind of lumped together two questions because there's actually a bunch of questions around finding, a psychologist, a therapist, a developmental pediatrician, and, questions that had something to do with like, what's wrong with you people? What's wrong with psychologists? So, which I love people asking that question because there is a lot wrong with us. The question, why do psychologists loathe to recognize PDA, even conceptually? And then the related question, are psychologists helpful with PDA at all if they aren't an expert? In my family, they've done damage, but they get into your head because they should be the experts. But you can't think, talk, count to 10 your way out of PDA because it's a nervous system response. Is it even worth trying to find a psychologist? Really good questions.
Yeah. So let's hear it. Like from your perspective, why? I mean, I have my opinion, but like.
Yeah, I want to hear it. Let's hear it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with myself and explain how it would feel to me. Okay. So I did 6 years of like a harrowing, very difficult doctorate degree in political science, right? Mm-hmm. And I was trained to think a certain way, and I had to go through my prelim exams, and I had to develop proposals and learn the whole canon and all this stuff, right? And then I was vetted by other people in the field, in the discipline, to determine if I could be part of the discipline with a doctorate, right? And right. So coming out of that, I am loath to have someone without a PhD in political science come tell me what political science theory is and what like the cutting edge of it is, right? And and from an arrogant place, this is pre me being brought to my knees. Did have a little bit of a chip on my shoulder when I was working in Washington, D.C., even in the policy and political realm of just like, I have a different degree of training that I went through. I've read everything that there has that's been published about this topic. Mm-hmm. You're bringing a topic to me that hasn't been published on, or very little has been published, and you're asking me to go against my training.
Right.
Right. And I think what saved me, the same thing that limited me, the training and the arrogance of the discipline, was also what saved me and allowed me to have a curiosity mindset, because I remembered the training of what it takes to expand our body of knowledge, which starts with a question, right? That we don't know the answer to, a hypothesis that we develop, and then we collect data. And I remember when I was doing my doctorate, I was researching something that hadn't been proven, right? And that's what you do. So I think it's a double-edged sword for a lot of highly educated psychologists who, have spent a large part of their life getting trained in really important stuff. And then a parent comes and they're like, wait, all your assumptions are going against what I'm observing. And
right.
And so the task becomes not letting the ego get in the way and not having a curiosity mindset.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of times when we don't know or something's new to us, our ego comes up and we're like resistant, right?
Right, right. Totally. That That's really my hypothesis. Resonates. That really strongly resonates from what I see a lot of the time, right? What you said about ego or, I think also related to what you're saying, I mean, people feel sort of uncomfortable not being an expert, right? Or, maybe a little bit of like a rigidity in the field around like, well, it's not in the DSM. So therefore, the highly sensitive person profile is not a thing. HSP profile, not a thing. Or PDA, not a thing. Like, it's either this or that based on our, So yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of like, the therapist, psychologist, the field feeling threatened that there's something that is like, ooh, this is not my wheelhouse. I think in general, whenever we have stuff that's coming outside the paradigm in some way, right? Like, what do you mean behaviorism isn't working for you? Like, if I'm the, people thinking that, like, this is a radical concept to maybe, right, for people who have only been trained in behaviorism, to think like, well, actually, you know, these concepts don't apply in the same way to all people at all times. And so how do we, you know, really think more flexibly, for sure? So I really agree with you around, you know, something about something getting in the way for the therapist, you know, and it's complicated because, I mean, there are also times where somebody might bring in something that is, again, like not in the DSM or, you know, a treatment or an intervention that, you know, I might worry about actually as not being great, right? So like there's, you know, it's hard to kind of have like one rule or something about how we think about these things, but it is certainly very complicated. But I think that, yeah, I really see that, you know, this question, why are psychologists loath to recognize PDA as like, this is not something we do. This is not something I'm trained in. This is not in the DSM. So like, you know, you are being, this is why there's implicit and explicit blame towards parents, right? Like, oh no, this isn't about my lack of knowledge base. Like you are not doing something right here, or you need to do something differently, which is so tough. So tough. Yeah. Yeah.
So before we move on to the next part of the question, I want to just ask you honestly, like, did you have resistance? Like when you first heard the terminology or the first learned about it? And if so, where did that come from? Or where did that lack of resistance come from?
That is a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, prior to learning about the diagnosis, the term PDA, it wasn't until maybe 2019 that I think was the year I came across it. And I, you know, had spent, you know, many years, you know, in thinking about sort of therapeutic models outside of ABA, for example. Like I was already critical of ABA. I'd already done, you know, like I mentioned in the last time we recorded, you know, like my dissertation on listening to autistic people and interviewing them about therapy approaches and treatment approaches. So, you know, I'm linking it to this concept because I think a lot of why I maybe didn't resist PDA is because I like saw the kinds of things that were being recommended. And I was like, yes, okay. Like now we're really getting somewhere. Like now we're really respecting the child more. Like now this is a more neurodiversity affirming way of sort of handling some of these kids where, you know, and are making recommendations to these families where A, B, and C hasn't worked. So I guess I kind of felt more validated than resistant in a way and curious. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes I think like everyone else, you know, I don't see myself or this field as being certain, you know, about like what is the right thing to do. You know, this is hard. Like the situations that the families are coming to me with are really tricky, really complicated. You know, so sometimes I think there's like, there's a bit of, and you talk about this a lot too, I know, Casey, like, you know, trial and error, like, let's think what's worked, what's not working, like, where do we make tweaks, right? And so I think, again, understanding of the PDA profile and some of the interventions and approaches and styles that are recommended with it are, you know, way more neurodiversity affirming, I think kind of better for everyone in a way too. So yeah, so maybe that's why I didn't have as much resistance to it, because I think I already kind of liked that before knowing that there is something already written about it or something, like, you know, I liked the recommendations before even knowing what they were, if that makes sense.
Makes sense. Totally makes sense.
But I feel it's also kind of sad to me, you know, like this question, related question, is it even worth trying to find a psychologist, right? I mean, like that, to me, the fact that we have many parents, you know, asking this kind of thing is like, hey, wake up call field of psychology. Like, you know, what's going on here? Like, where's the disconnect? And so, I mean, I'm never going to tell somebody not to try to find a psychologist. But what I do know is that the parents I talk to are like, they are burnt out from feeling invalidated. Like, they're threshold or their ability to tolerate like another person that feels like they're not getting it or making the wrong recommendations is like zero a lot of the time, right? And so, you know, and then there's maybe some times where there's more ability to tolerate that than others, you know, and so maybe that's when we're working to sort of find somebody. And I do think that it's interestingly, like you would think that somebody with a background working with autistic people and, you know, is going to be better for this. But on the other hand, some of that background might be even more kind of immersed in the traditional approaches. And I've even found that some people, even if they're not, you know, don't have a specialty in autism or neurodivergence, but they're very trauma-informed, they're very have a very much a relationship-first mentality. And the trauma-informed piece is important because many of the most of the pediatrics have experienced trauma, and the parents too have experienced different types of trauma from, you know, for various reasons. And so, you know, there are people you can find that are going to believe you what you're saying, right? And so I don't think it's hopeless. Like, I think we can get there. I actually think it is increasing. Like, there is, you know, a larger list. I know you know, people on your website, Casey, you know, referrals of clinicians across the country. PDA North America has an expanding list of people who are across the country, and many of whom, this is not true in California where I live, but other states, like states can have reciprocity with each other. So one person who's licensed in Indiana could work with somebody in Connecticut or something like that. And so, you know, like there's, it is growing. Like there's access to people that are PDA affirmative, and it is growing. That's the good news, but we are far from being good enough because majority of people are not there.
Yeah. I think, like, you know, parents always ask, like, you know, are there buzzwords to look for? Are there things to look for? And like, I agree with you, like trauma-informed, neurodiversity affirming, often when it's, you know, LGBTQIA affirming, just like affirming of marginalized identities means there has been already some letting go of the dominant paradigm. So even if it's not a specialization in PDA, but I think like there's like two things to think about at the very core, which is like, are they taking a behavioral approach? You know, parent-child interaction therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. This is not exposure-based therapy. It's not to say these are bad therapies. It's just probably not going to be the best fit for a PDA kid or parent at first when you're like getting out of burnout, establishing trust. And then second, can you establish a horizontal relationship with the psychologist or the doctor? Because if they're coming at you already from a place of like, I know more than you do, then even if they say I'm PDA affirming on their website, it's not gonna work.
No, you're right.
And the parent probably has a little bit of their own drive for autonomy and equality.
Yeah.
So like, you're not going to like jive.
That is a good point, right? Yeah. The vibe of the clinician, right? Not just their training or the theoretical background, but also like, are they treating you with respect and evaluating your autonomy and inputs, right? And you know, that's going to be a better person that to be working with for sure.
Totally.
And usually you can get a vibe on that early on within a couple of sessions.
No, I agree. And then more, I mean, if this is an adult asking it, I know for my own nervous system work, exploring things like EMDR or somatic processing or internal family systems or things that maybe aren't like as behaviorally based and are more body based can be supportive. Yeah. But again, following your intuition, right? Like, do you feel safe with this person? If not, it's not a good fit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Like full stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I do feel like OTs, you know, like sometimes are like a better fit overall. I mean, there's exceptions. Like I've seen OTs and heard of OTs doing things that are really not good, you know, harmful. So, you know, I'm not generalizing too much, but I would say overall, you know, you might find, you know, them a little more likely to follow kids' lead, be looking at nervous system regulation, be more thoughtful about what is the right level of challenge, right? That concept of the just right challenge, I think you and I talked about the last time, was something that came out of the OT world. And so, yeah, sometimes with OTs, you know, that can be a little bit safer. But yeah, again, we've got a long way to go in everyone's sort of recognition of PDA and openness to alternative strategies, right? Yeah. And, you know, I think every time we come outside the mainstream, like, even though I think you and I, as you and I have talked about, like that's how knowledge is produced and you know, we move in the right direction, hopefully, you know, but that's always going to come with a bit of like pushback or resistance or anxiety. We could come outside the paradigm.
Totally. 100%.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question. Should we go the ABA route or the OCD route?
Oh man, there are so many questions for both.
We're going to talk again soon, so
Okay.
we can just go where your heart desires.
Maybe the next one on the list,
All
and
right.
then we'll do
Well,
the OCD one next time
okay.
if the ABA, because it looks like ABA is next on our list.
Totally. Okay.
Yeah.
What do you do if ABA is recommended and you feel it will backfire and PDA is not recognized by the person that recommends it?
Oh, I feel like you and I are going to agree a lot on this. Well, what are your thoughts there, Casey?
Well, okay, it should be a simple answer, but like
No, it's not a simple answer, actually. I don't, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I'm thinking about what I teach in the last module of the paradigm shift, which is the advocacy module, and it's like
Yeah.
there's a couple steps that I have parents go through. So the first one is like recognize it's that before you even say anything, if they've recommended this and you know it's not right, before you've even asked a question or said, no, we're not going to do this, it's very likely that you as a parent are feeling some anxiety, if not true nervous system activation around this, because a lot of parents I work with have a tendency to fawn, are internalized PDAers themselves or people pleasers, right? And
Yeah.
definitely, so like recognizing that, like before you've done any of what I'm about to say, it's going to be hard. But the
Yeah.
first step is to think about, like, can you make a request, a specific request? And I encourage parents to think about, like, instead of being like, oh, that's not going to work for PDA, it could be a specific request, like, oh, thanks for that information. Could you provide me with two or three other options of types of therapies that are not based in behavioralism within a 10-mile radius or 30-mile radius of our city? Right? So, like, you're not getting into a power struggle, you're just making a request, right? And then the answer is going to be yes or no. No is a data point, yes is problem solving together, right? If it's no, then we move to boundaries, or if it's a conflict, we might move to pruning, which is like choosing a different doctor. But I know that's a whole can of worms with insurance. So, you know, I've worked with clients who felt that they had to do what the doctor said or else they would get in trouble. You know, even if there weren't custody things going on or marginalized identities going on, which makes it even more scary to be like, no, we're not going to do what this authority figure says. But like truly feeling like they're going to get in trouble if they don't do what the doctor said and having a fawn response. So bringing mindfulness to at least having the right to, at the very least, just be like, yeah, thanks for the information. We're going to think about it, right? Instead of automatic yesing, because I think this is more complex than just like quote advocacy of like just being like, oh, I'm not going to do that, because it's there's so much wrapped up in power dynamics and like who has letters after their name and how insurance can cover things. So that's where I usually start with parents.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I like what you brought up about insurance. I mean, so many thoughts come up with this question, should I do ABA? And then this parent is saying, what do you do if it's recommend ABA is recommended and you feel it will backfire? So this parent is already having a gut sense that this will backfire, right? So first of all, like that is important to listen to because I think parents do have good instincts and should trust their instincts, you know, and that's hard, especially when you have like, you know, people saying like, oh, like this is the diagnosis, like here's some, you know, you should do ABA, right? So that's hard sometimes to trust your gut instinct. I mean, a really important point in some ways that I think you could say the most important point is that we do have a lot of autistic adults have been speaking out for years now, you know, against ABA and against many practices of ABA. So we definitely need to be kind of open and thoughtful about that. You know, I mean, there's many problems that have been discussed around ABA, but some core ones might have to do with, you know, the overemphasis on compliance, the lack, you know, and, you know, too much of a top-down, adult-directed, do this reward system, you know, that may or may not be working for your kid, or, you know, over focus on like of social skills to look more neurotypical. Like these are, there's a lot of problematic, but that's not a neurodiversity affirming approach to, you know, we want to sort of honor the way people are. So, you know, there's more to talk about with that, but just sort of as that backdrop, like I do think it's important that people know, and I think a lot of people do know now that there is, you know, a lot of criticism of ABA. But, you know, autistic people are not a monolith, like, and there is still diversity of opinion within the autistic community. And your point around, you know, what is covered by insurance, like, or what are the resources of the family and what does the family have access to, like, is a really good one. And I really strongly agree with that. And, you know, if, and maybe there are situations where, like you said, you know, family is advocating for, you know, like, hey, okay, we really want to have a say in what the goals are here, like what we're working on and how we're going to go about achieving those goals. And I think that if the intuition of the parent and, you know, who's done their research and is like, okay, this is not jiving with my philosophy and my approach, like, that's a real problem. And the other thing to be thinking about is like, well, why are we doing ABA? And like, what, or more broadly, what are we looking for help with? And why are we looking for help with that? And the answer to those questions are very varied, but there's always going to be multiple paths towards growth and help and support. So, you know, even if ABA is the only thing that is sort of recommended, there is more out there, right? And so there is variability in what parents will have access to based on insurance and finances and all of that. And that's important. So I think, you know, there are ways that, like, I don't think it's helpful to think in a very absolutist way, like, you know, yes or no in every circumstance. Like, so, you know, there could absolutely be an ABA provider maybe who is, I think I used this example, you know, in last time we talked, who's sort of taking the kid to the dentist office just to kind of get more comfortable there. And that's something that's like super helpful, right? Yeah, you know, yeah. Not to do much. Or, you know, there's ways that we can try and advocate for more neuroaffirming practices, like even within, even if ABA broadly is not neuroaffirming or the philosophy is not neuroaffirming and certainly not the history is not neuroaffirming, there's still things we can advocate for. So, you know, thinking, you know, and as you said too, I mean, culturally this is different. Like, so for example, the notion of compliance, you know, if you are a, you know, an African-American teenager who has an interaction, you know, who's autistic or has a disability, has an interaction with the police, for example, like maybe being compliant is the most, you know, that's going to be really important for one's survival potentially, right? So I don't really think in like absolutist ways. I really think we have to look at the nuance of what's going on in any given family and any given situation. But this parent is like saying in their gut, you know, like, I'm feeling like this is going to backfire. You know, I'd pay attention to that. So
yeah,
that's what I can say there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like, I also want to say, I would never judge a parent who chooses to do ABA because, like,
right.
For example, I had a family go through the Paradigm Shift program, and we do cost benefit decision making within constraints and looking at data in their particular home. And mm-hmm. This child hadn't been able to access school for over a year, was externalized PDA, very social, and had great relationships with the therapist at ABA. I would say, I really want to go, right? And was getting the dopamine, the novelty, this, you know, the special interest of the other nervous systems. And it wasn't this as extreme, but it was like what the kid got to do outside of the school.
Yeah.
And could access. And the mom was torn up inside because she was like, you know, is this child abuse? You know, like, I've read all this stuff about ABA from advocates, mm-hmm. but like what I'm observing and hearing from my 10-year-old is that like, he's begging me not to take this away from him. So like, how do we make this decision? So
right.
It really is
autonomy and decision-making of the child too. Yeah, yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, but I love how you said, like, the underlying philosophy, we can disagree with that, or the history, but how it manifests in every town in the U.S., in every clinic, in every practitioner, you know, I also don't like to make these blanket statements about, like, this is bad and this is good in a normative sense.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, we could kind of rethink, you know, throw out and recreate the whole system, right? Like, and we could say that for a lot of things, I think. But, you know, again, like what's covered? What do families have access to? Like we have to think that way. But again, I don't know, like sometimes I found there's so many reasons why it's not just the philosophy that parents might be reluctant to ABA. Some of them have tried it before, but there's such a high turnover of the clinician, really common problem across the country that can happen. Higher
Yeah,
turnover, so a kid starts.
it's a huge corporation with a monopoly,
Right, exactly.
right? Like
And
it's a
then,
corporate monopoly because it's like this is the only thing that's covered by insurance, and now every autistic family in the United States only has coverage for this, right? And so it's like, yeah, the system needs to be, if not dismantled, at least have competition, right? Like if
Well,
we're a free
yeah, and this
market
is
society, like
advocacy,
we say we are, at
right?
least let other types of therapy compete, right?
Exactly. And this is a broader advocacy issue. Actually, in California, we've made some progress towards that and sort of a more access to insurance coverage for different therapies. But that is not true of many, many, many states. So yeah, it is such a tough issue for sure.
It is. Okay. We
And
ranted and we raved, and I had
we
so much
ranted
fun
and
with
we
you.
waved. Yes, as always, I loved all those questions that people sent in. And so yes, we'll have to tap into more of them.
Okay, we'll pick up on the OCD next time and
Sure.
we'll go back to our list of questions and we'll just keep going.
Awesome. I love it. Great to chat,
Well, it's
Casey.
so nice to connect. All right.
Okay, you too. Take
Bye.
care. Bye-bye.
Thanks everyone for being here with me at the At Peace Parents podcast. This is your source for all things related to understanding, supporting, accommodating, and advocating for your PDA child. To go deeper on any of these topics, check out my course offerings and masterclasses at the website www.atpeaceparents.com. To completely transform the way you think about and relate to your child and to bring peace and stability to your home, join us for the next cohort of the Paradigm Shift program.